Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, they did it again. Disney did it again. They remade one of their newer classics. We're going to talk about the remake of The Lion King. We're also going to talk about what I believe may be one of the worst films of the year called Stuber. And we're going to talk about a documentary that you had me watch called Bethany Hamilton, Unstoppable. But first, I did try to match the wine, and I already gave you a warning. Said, folks, you're going to hear an audible eye roll when she analyzes this wine.
Well, I think we've actually had this one before.
We've had the brand, but I don't think we've had this vintage.
The vintage, which is a Pinot Noir called The Punishment.
Because if all day, every day, you go and hang out in a shark's house, you best be ready for the punishment.
Oh, that's really sad. That's the best you can do? Come on.
What?
No, I thought you were going to be referencing that maybe, you know, the documentary I had you watch was Punishment or Stuber was Punishment.
So no, you're in a shark's bedroom. You know, be prepared. As Scar would say, well, be prepared.
But I brought you a little beer because I figured it's called the two-time smash. And I thought, you know what? The Lion King was a pretty big smash the first time around. And no matter what, I think it's going to be a pretty big smash this second time
around. Well, I recognize the, that's no slouch beer. That's Southern Tier. I love Southern Tier because every October they release Pumpkin, which is one of my favorite beers.
Wow. Well, so here you go. Hooray. I've brought you a gift.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
Speaking of gifts that just keep on giving, Disney remakes. We've talked about a few this year. We started with Dumbo. Terrible Dumbo. Yeah. I skipped Aladdin because I'm just tired of Disney remakes.
But
Hannah
Aladdin.
Enjoyed Aladdin very much. Now, The Lion King, I was 13, 14 when that came out. And what I remember is you are either, you fell in love with The Lion King. The Lion King is it. Don't you? Oh, Mufasa, Simba, the whole circle of life. Can you feel the love? Elton John. People just never got over The Lion King. They never got over it. And those are going to be the people who rave about the remake. Oh, it's so good. It's so real. Look at those lions. They're so real. And then there's people like me. I didn't hate The Lion King. I was, you know, I thought it was okay. I actually preferred Aladdin. I thought Aladdin was punchier. It was poppier. And The Lion King was kind of such a downer. And yay, he gets his in the end. But man, what a journey to get there. So I never latched on to The Lion King. So I'm not latching on to this film either. That's my premise. Whatever you felt about the original is how you're probably going to feel about this one. Agree or disagree?
I agree to some degree. I think that I was in that same camp. I was much older when the 1994 version came out. And so I'm not sure where my mindset was in terms of watching an animated movie and if I saw it with other kids. But I remember really enjoying the music. I mean, you can't go wrong with like Elton John songs. And is it Tim Rice lyrics, perhaps? It's always going to be good. And so you have the same good songs. For me, what was memorable about the first one is still memorable in this one, but I did not get the feel. Some people were saying that the realism of this CGI and this incredible visual new technology that they incorporate into this version made it even bigger for its heart and its scariness and all the emotional stuff. I didn't feel that because I knew exactly what was coming. And it was almost, it felt almost shot for shot, except somehow it manages to be a half hour longer than the animated version.
There's more filler scenes, you know, like Simba chasing butterflies and bugs.
Yeah, they go longer.
There's some more exposition. What I noticed is computer technicians, specifically Disney computer technicians, have figured out how to make computer lions look like real lions. So congratulations, you did it, bros. If only they could make computer something look like real something, but an original story, then you would have me. Then I would really perk up and pay attention. About how the lions look and how everything looks, there's another split. There's those that say, it's so real. They look like, that's a real lion singing. It's a real warthog. And a lot of people say it's the stuff of nightmares. That warthog is so real. Other people say, this is the uncanny valley. Like, it looks so real, it's fake. Like, when his paws are on the ground and he's singing in the jungle, half the people, maybe not half, 25% of the people say, this looks fake and ridiculous, and it's all beige. Where's the color? Because the cartoon was color saturated. And 75% are saying, this is the greatest visual effects they've ever seen in their entire lives.
Well, the filmmakers went to great lengths to actually go out to the... to Africa and, you know, look at the mountains and the desert. And so they actually were really basing the color saturation and the visuals on the reality. And that it is very impressive. It took me a little time to get used to seeing a talking lion and a talking cub. Like, it just was a little off-putting to me initially, because as an when you're watching animation, you forgive all of that stuff. It's part and parcel of watching an animated movie. But this hybrid of this feeling and look of realism, and yet having this aspect of it that certainly is not real, it took a little adjusting. I would say it was about 15 minutes or so of getting used to the mouths moving and singing and talking for these computer-generated animals. But it is like watching, you feel in some ways like you're watching an episode of Animal Kingdom and just suddenly they burst into song and can talk. I did absolutely get it. We saw it in IMAX, which I think is a really cool experience. There's nothing quite like seeing a film that is meant to just be so visually impressive on that big of a screen. So it's the same to me. It's the same story, and there will be a divide. I was surprised to hear that some people were kind of sniffling, you know, in parts of this movie. It just didn't get me that way. I did not ever feel that gut punch, even with the not spoiler death of Mufasa towards the beginning. I remember being almost more emotionally impacted by it the first time. In the animated version. By now, there's just something about knowing every step of the way exactly how it's going to play out that just kind of pulls back a little bit for me on the emotional, you know, pull of the whole thing.
I'm with you. I didn't get the feels either, and that's because I'm just so familiar with the story. I know the exact three-act structure, and I just kept waiting. Okay, this is next. Okay, this is next. And I brought my six-year-old, and I was looking at him, and he never saw the cartoon version. This is his first Lion King, so I was ready. I was ready for his childhood to end and transition. When Mufasa goes, I'm looking straight at him, staring at the screen, and nothing. It's like water off a duck's back.
Sorry,
it's like, oh, Mufasa's dead? So I got to thinking, did we, as a culture, over-dramatize Mufasa's death? I remember I felt it more in 1994, but, you know, am I just desensitized to it now, or has it just become over-mythologized? Like, oh, the death of Mufasa, yes, that's when my childhood ended, blah, blah, blah.
When you do, it's somebody was saying, can you imagine if they did this with Bambi? You know, if they did that kind of animation and you witnessed the death of Bambi's mother in this way. I'm not sure. I think people would have a really, really hard time with it. And to me, the realism just made the dark stuff darker. I was so relieved when Pumbaa and Timon showed up and you knew suddenly it was like, okay, here's where the movie starts getting a little more light and fun. But yeah, you knew it was coming. So then as soon as you saw those characters appear, you kind of breathed a sigh of relief knowing that the worst was kind of behind you up until the very end. And so knowing exactly how that was all going to track did sort of just shift the whole way the film was paced for me. But I enjoyed those lighter moments, and it helps sort of be the benchmarks with the big songs. You know Circle of Life. You know Hakuna Matata is coming. So the classics are the classics. The classic songs are still the classic songs. If you asked me what the name or to recite what the original song that was added to this film was, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Was it over the closing credits? Was that Beyonce song?
I don't. I'm not even sure. I'm sure that the closing credits song was definitely probably new.
I listened to the new Beyonce song yesterday. It's called Spirit, and it's okay.
Oh, no, it's fine in, like, as a standalone to kind of hear it and see a music video with that song. But in terms of connecting a song to the scenes that I saw in the film, I'm still going to know Holding Up the Cub in the Circle of Life playing.
Oh, yeah.
And those,
mm-hmm.
And even when this film starts and you get those first strings of that song, and you just know that it's opening in that glorious sort of Animal Kingdom sort of way.
Yeah, well, they have that wide panoramic mm-hmm. shot with all the grassland animals bowing to the new cub. What I noticed, and my biggest takeaway from this is it's weightier, it's moodier. So if in the original cartoon, Scar, the violent antagonist, was a 4, he's an 8 now. It's more, there's like hints of blood, actually, and it's more violent. This is more violent. There's sinew and tendons involved. Timon and Pumbaa, they were a 5 in the original. They're a 7 now. They're snarkier.
Mm-hmm.
They're still funny, but actually there's some undercurrents of punch. I don't remember in the jungle from the rhythm. They do a very good version of it's a very good, it really lightens the mood after a big downer. There's a visual representation I really appreciated of the Circle of Life when Simba loses some hair and it goes and winds its way through a very interesting arc, how it winds back up with the baboon, I guess is what it is, and he recognizes who it is, and it's actually a representation of what Mufasa was talking about, the Circle of Life. I'm like, oh, I do not remember that from the first film. So good on him. But it's not original. I've been there, done that. I've got this, okay, it's a checkbox feeling. I've seen it now. Let's move on to the inevitable next one. It looks like something I guess I've never seen before.
But there was a lot of talk when we came out of the screening. Somebody was talking about how this was trying to already set itself up for a Best Picture nomination.
Not in a million years.
I didn't feel that way. And apparently they added one scene that would disqualify it intentionally from the animated category in order to kind of force it into the Best Picture category.
So just a landscape shot?
Whatever it is, it's just one thing. And I think that's, I think that was a misstep because I really don't.
No, it won't be.
I don't see this. And in terms of like an animated film, I think there was more, something at least new to something like Toy Story 4. And even Aladdin as the live action remake managed to find, I think, a stronger balance between the familiar and inserting something fresh so that you weren't seeing exactly the same thing. And with this, you are really seeing the exact same thing, but just in a different technology format. But far better than Dumbo, so I can easily give it that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is not the worst Disney remake I've seen this year.
No, I think it'll do well no matter what.
Of course it's going to do. It's going to rake in $1 billion.
It's going to be one of those things that's, you talk about how your son saw it for the first time, just as this version. That's, to me, that's really why some of these things come around again.
Nope, that's not why this came around.
Well, money?
Yes.
Yes, but that is. It's money because you can pull a double audience.
They can.
You can pull this whole new generation, and for the nostalgia factor, you can pull the people who had already seen it before. And it also has the benefit of, the stage play has been around for years now in the interim. So I saw the stage play, the stage musical, just last year. So you figure it's still because it was there. And so that's just it. It's the music. For me, it's about kind of just hearing that music again. And that's the nostalgia part. The story, absolutely nothing new there.
Talking about nothing new and rehash of things I know I've seen before, but I haven't seen it this way. Stuber. Stuber, Stu, drives an Uber, Stuber. And here's, you want to hear the world's worst log line? The log line is like that one sentence there. If someone says, what's this movie about? And you give them that one sentence, and it either hooks them or it doesn't. So here's Stuber's log line. A seeing eye Uber for a detective who can't see.
That's so convoluted, which was part of the problem with the title Stuber to begin with. I could not remember what movie I was going into. I'm like, what's this one called? And yeah, sure. Once you realize that it's Stu plus Uber equals Stuber, then the title makes sense. But it's if you're just trying to figure out, and it sets itself up for that headline. The tagline is going to be, you know, Stuber is a stupid does or something, because that really it's a pretty stupid movie, but it's summer. And we had this argument last week.
No. Don't do this, Hannah.
You know, I was surprised it's R-rated. It's way more violent than R-rated. I had anticipated. Yeah, no, but I was like, you know what? I kept thinking, man, go see John Wick 3 first. If you're like into seeing some action film that will just take you away for a bit and you're okay with sort of the violence and the bloodshed and the craziness, then John Wick gives you all that plus more. And so I would certainly recommend that if John Wick is still playing out there and you're debating between the R-rated John Wick and the R-rated Stuber, there's just not even
I can't imagine there's choice. A human being on Earth debating between John Wick and Stuber.
I do. People who haven't seen John Wick 1 and 2 would not necessarily feel inclined to go see 3. To me, Stuber is very much like a hyper-violent ride-along, and except that instead of some sort of guy riding along with a cop who in a patrol car, it's an Uber driver riding along with a cop in his Uber.
Well, it actually reminded me of Collateral, when Tom Cruise, the assassin, gets in Jamie Foxx's cab and makes him take him around the city in one night to kill some people, except it's the exact opposite of Collateral, and it sucks. So we've got Dave Bautista. Many people know him from the WWE. He was a villain on that show, a foil for usually like The Rock. Many others know him as Drax from the Guardians of the Galaxy. He's the guy who does not understand sarcasm, and he's really funny.
Yes, he's very funny.
So he is a middle-aged cop, and he loses his partner early on, and he has these horrible glasses. He can't see.
Well, he's had LASIK surgery.
Well, we're getting there.
Cut right through it.
He gets LASIK surgery in the morning of this day. This one day that it takes place in, he gets LASIK surgery. And of course, right afterwards, he gets the phone call, hey, the big deal's going down tonight. He'll be there. You know, the guy he's chasing, it doesn't matter who he's chasing, the drug dealer. The big deal's going down tonight, and he can't see. So he gets Uber, and Uber just got put on his phone that morning by his daughter, who of course has a gallery show that night, can't miss it, father-daughter drama. And Kumail Nanjiani is driving the Uber. And before we talk about any more of this, whatever the plot is, I want to talk about Kumail Nanjiani. Mm-hmm. The entire world, some people knew him from Silicon Valley, most didn't. Everybody learned who he was when he did The Big Sick, and he was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay alongside his wife for telling their story about how they met and how they came to be. The Big Sick, an indie smash. And his thanks, his promotion in Hollywood was Stuber.
Yeah. Well, but that's, I wouldn't be surprised. It'll be fascinating to see how much money Stuber makes in the end versus The Big Sick. We'll see. Ooh. Because I think Stuber is going to have,
I don't think it's going to make very much money.
I think it's going to have a second life in the streaming market and in the rental. I think this is totally the kind of movie that you're just going to like call up on the airplane when you're just looking for something to kill some time. And especially if you like Kumail Nanjiani, if you're a fan of his, and if you happen to be a fan of Dave Bautista, then, you know, and you're just looking for a comedy, then you might hit, yes, I'll start watching that renting it.
I don't even want to believe it.
I know you don't, but I make this argument every week with when there's those stupid, silly escape movies, there is sometimes a market for them.
But I actually don't think this is really going to I don't think this is going to hit. I don't think it's going to make money.
I don't think so either, but I think it's because nobody's going to even remember what the name was and what it was supposed to be about.
I think it's too late. Yeah. Like, it's too... Remember when Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson did that comedy about Google, which was 10 years too late? This is too... It does all the Uber stereotypes about the different people that call Ubers and how horrible they are. And it has a montage of that. And it's like, this is 3 years too late.
Yeah, all the best lines are actually in the trailer, and they just relate to... Here's this Uber driver who's just down on his luck that night, whose five-star rating is in jeopardy of being diminished because of a series of really bad passengers. And so he's sort of putting everything, he's just holding out hope that somehow this next ride will get him back up to five stars. And so anybody who's ridden an Uber and understands that whole dynamic of the rating of both the passengers and the drivers, that's where sort of the humor does come from.
No doubt.
It is a little, it's a little too little too late, definitely. And all I kept thinking was, yeah, I would, as much as I would love to be able to give Stuber five stars, I'd give this one like 2.5.
Now, there's two funny lines. I give this one star, by the way. It's an odd couple. You know, he's the straight guy, or, you know, he's the straight cop, and he's kind of the mouthy sidekick who shouldn't be there, who's out of his element. He's in over his head. He reminded me of Steve Carell from Date Night, and with him and Tina Fey. You lived in Los Angeles. I only know Los Angeles from the movies. This is bathed. It's tinted in like red orange. It's like the hottest day of the year. And they take him all over the city, and they do it on such an overt, in-your-face way. He's like, take me to Koreatown. Take me to Compton. Take me to Venice. Take me to Inglewood.
And I can tell you, you'd be there for 4 days if you actually had to go from all one place to the next, because you don't get anywhere that quickly in LA for, you know, in reality. Especially if it's a weekday, I'm not sure whether it was supposed to be that or
and
not.
And they diagnose each other. Like, psychologically, it reminded me of Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal in Analyze This. He's like, you know what your problem is. Oh, yeah, well, you know what your problem is. And they get into each other's chili. Camille Nanjiani just wants to go to this chick's house. He's starting a business. It's called Spinsters for women bicyclists. Yes, that's...
Spinners.
It's spinsters.
No, but for the women spinners.
Oh, is that a thing? Is that really called spinners?
Yeah, spinning.
No, I just thought it was spinsters.
No. The whole point is it's spinning class.
Well, I know what it is, but I just thought, yes, I see what they did there.
Spinning class.
But, you know, that doesn't go anywhere.
For you, but it might for some.
The villain who pops up, I can't believe she's in this movie. I can't believe she's in this movie. Yeah, I don't want to say any more about stupid.
No, but I'll just, I'm not as, my vitriol isn't nearly as deep as yours for this film, but I would just say that it is relying, it's basically this movie you've seen before in some form, and it's relying on these amusing one-liners, most of which you will have already seen in the trailer,
Kerplunk
and these
thud.
Physical, and a lot of physical gags. You know, with the...
There's a dog on the poster.
Yeah, there's a dog on the poster. And the dog's in the movie for like 30 seconds. I thought that's the first thing I thought of too, is I'm like, wait, that's false advertising to put that dog in there when he really does not have a very big role. But I just think that they're trying to use these one-liners and the physical comedy and stuff to obscure the fact that it really is just your formulaic, predictable film with a very thin plot.
It is honestly one of the three worst movies I have seen this year. Easily.
I just put it in that not memorable. Not terrible, but not memorable. And I can't really recommend anybody go see this over things like... There's just too much else out there right now if you're going to see Spider-Man or Yesterday. There's just plenty of other things to choose from that are better that it just doesn't really make sense to actually go to the theater for this one.
Speaking of, you probably shouldn't go to the theater. Who is Bethany Hamilton? Why is she famous?
Well, she's famous because at the age of, I think, 13, she was bitten by a tiger shark and had her arm bitten off.
That's
and she was a surfer. And she was an up-and-coming surfer. And here was this 13-year-old who overcame tremendous adversity, not only just kind of kept a pretty good outlook on life in the midst of this tragedy, but she went on to compete and still become a professional world-class surfer. And by so you put all that together, you think, oh my gosh, the makings of a fascinating documentary.
Well, did you got see, sharks. Did you see the movie that was made about her already Surfer called Girl? Soul Surfer?
Soul Surfer.
I did not.
I didn't either. And when I suspect that Soul Surfer is probably better because when you can actually make something more, when you can create a little more drama, this was, for all the elements that this documentary has, it was so boring. I could not believe
it's not about the
how
shark attack.
Dull it was. It's not about the shark attack. Apparently, this film was, this documentary was like 6 years in the making, and it was only supposed to be a short documentary about Bethany. And the documentary, the filmmaker decided that as Bethany decided she was going to take on bigger challenges, and as she got married and had a kid, that he was going to incorporate all this additional stuff into the documentary. And all it did was make it longer and more tedious to watch. I was bummed because I did want to see this. And it opens, it's beautiful. It's got this great score and you're like ready to go and get this great moving story. But it didn't know what it wanted to be. Structurally, narratively, it did not work for me. And so so I found it to be quite the disappointment.
I agree that it meanders, and it includes everything, even the tiniest little Teen Choice Awards appearance. It includes everything, but yes, it is gorgeous, but it doesn't matter because it's so vacuous. And what I felt, what I took away from this is not necessarily an altruistic documentary. You know what this does, Bethany Hamilton : Unstoppable? Is it maintains, it sustains the Bethany Hamilton brand. She is a brand. She could not compete on the real professional surfing circuit. Okay, I get it. Let's find something else to do. And what she found was Oprah, Ellen, The Amazing Race.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Many other
with her,
ventures.
With her cute husband, you and know, then, and cute kid, and it became a package.
And so that's what, thank you, the package. This sells, this is selling me the Bethany Hamilton package, and I didn't like it.
Well, but see, it had the opposite effect on me. It diminished the brand as opposed to enhancing the brand. And there were tidbits. I wanted to know things. It's like, yes, great that they have this footage from how optimistic and strong she still was in the aftermath of this attack. But they never explain anything really about why she chooses never to have a prosthetic arm, that she chooses to surf and you know, everything.
I bet a prosthesis would hurt her brand.
I'm sure. Well, I think it would. It probably has something to do with balance and, you know, things like that. There's probably a very good, legitimate reason for making that choice.
If she does that, though, she's no longer the one-armed surfer.
But I don't think it was a brand choice. I think it was a balance on the surfboard
choice.
No,
they didn't talk about it.
Exactly. And so it's things like that I would have liked to get a little more depth. And you were worried when I first suggested, you know, we just even at least see it, that it was going to be one of these faith-based films.
It kind of was.
And it goes there. That's where I'm saying it doesn't know what it wants to be. It goes there sort of periodically in very random ways. And so, yeah, overall a disappointment. I would just also point out that you've got this one coming out as Maiden is still expanding in cities across.
Not even close.
Not even close. And so this is one where, again, if you have to choose and you know that you're going into a theater and you kind of want to see some girl power inspirational film, oh my gosh, choose Maiden about the first all-female yacht crew racing around the world versus Bethany Hamilton Unstoppable about the 13-year-old shark attack victim who becomes a surfing champion. Maiden is just a much better documentary.
Thankfully, I believe Maiden has a much wider distribution. It's in more theaters than Bethany Hamilton Unstoppable, which will be on Lifetime probably next week.
Yes, but Maiden is rolling out. They took an approach where they are rolling out throughout the summer so that word of mouth can build so that once it does show up where you are,
hopefully more people are aware of it, and word of mouth will help help sustain it. And
word so of maiden.
Word of maiden. And hopefully the victory of, you know, the interest in the Women's World Cup soccer and all that, hopefully will just help keep people's
What a great mind. Idea to release Maiden during the Women's World Cup. Yeah. It's so, they match.
Totally. It's that you go, girl.
Like half of them look like Megan Rapinoe.
They do. And so I think that is the much stronger, better compliment to watch Maiden instead.
Did you watch a second documentary this week?
I did.
You're on this kick. Tell me everything about, and I know when I said it, it's like, I don't know who these people are, and then I really read about it. Oh, Leonard Cohen. Yeah. I love Leonard Cohen. I have his greatest hits CD.
I can't believe you didn't watch it.
I love Leonard Cohen.
And how did you not watch this film?
Because I did anything else.
Because Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love, actually is doing very well in the documentary market. It's, you know, it's getting a little bit of buzz out there. I didn't know anything. I certainly didn't know who Marianne was, who's actually referenced in a Leonard Cohen song called Marianne. Yeah, it's just, I think you would have liked it. It's not a great documentary. We've seen sort of that kind of, oh, let's go and look at the bohemian vibe of where some guy went to get his inspiration among other artists in the 60s. And so that part of it was a little familiar, but I didn't know about this story. It's basically this meant to be this enduring love story between Leonard Cohen, best known really, I think, for the song Hallelujah, and this Norwegian muse that he met named Marianne Eklund, and they had some big affair. They fell in love on the Greek island of Hydra. And I never knew how you were supposed to say H-Y-D-R-A as the Greek island, but it's Hydra.
It's not Hydra.
It's not Hydra.
It's not the
it's
villain.
It's not the villainous whatever
in,
it is.
And Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
No. So I'm very excited that I learned how to, I think, correctly pronounce the Greek island of Hydra. You know, they met in the 1960s. But then it really is about how Leonard Cohen just was that type of artist who suffered from, you know, battled depression and could never really settle down. And he had this on-again, off-again relationship with Marianne, and it kind of spanned like 50 years. But he was never one to just be like happy in any circumstance.
Not with those songs he wrote.
Right. And so you really learn about where the genesis of his music and his lyrics. And he really never intended to be to sing his own songs. And so it was very
it's
interesting.
Got the most famous bass of all time.
Yeah. But so I learned, you know, the reason I thought you would like it is because you talk about how it's always good when you just learn something new, especially
this
about
somebody.
That's
why it's more important for you to watch it.
No,
I already know who he was.
No, but you don't. You think you do. But that's where, you know, you don't know what he was like in this era of free love and open marriage and
stuff.
Well,
I don't want to know what it's like to have a Norwegian muse, because what if I run off and try to get one? That sounds awesome. I want a Norwegian muse.
You're going to get in trouble. But so it kind of comes full circle at the end ended up dying like 6 months apart.
Yeah, he died recently, too.
Recently. They both died recently and just not too far apart. And she had gone back to Norway.
Spoilers.
And and he had, you know, gone on and done his whole thing and split his time always between like New York and Greece and
as
wherever
he does,
pop around. And so, yeah, I just it's an interesting film. It really doesn't. I kept expecting to hear more about Hallelujah. All it showed was some little snippet where it sounds like he didn't share proper credit with somebody else who was supposed to get some credit on that song. Got no royalties. So that was an interesting little bit that I think prevented you from really hearing the Hallelujah song.
Well, yeah, you don't watch this. This does not sound like a biography straight up of Leonard Cohen.
No,
this is Leonard and there's someone else's name in the title.
It's right. It's Marianne and Leonard and their words of love and how they'd exchanged letters and kind of went, kind of found each other again periodically over the years, but then also went their separate ways. And she had gotten remarried and she had a kid. And so it's just it's an interesting documentary. It's not a great documentary. It certainly was way more watchable than Bethany Hamilton.
Colon.
Unstoppable.
Hey, you put a colon in the title. I'm going to call
this,
you on
this one does that. It is Marianne and Leonard.
Colon.
Words of love.
Oh, very good.
So there very you good. Go.
Oh, they actually took a Mamas of the Papas song and made it that second part of the title. Anyways, something else is releasing this week that I really wanted to see that's opening cold. That has 85% on the tomato meter. 85%. Alligators and crocodiles are eating people, Hannah.
Is that the Crawl
They're
movie?
Eating people.
Crawl?
85%.
You know, and everybody, a couple of people I know saw it, and they said it's just absolutely ridiculous, absurd, and
I loved
horrifying,
it.
But somehow they were entertained.
Because it's probably awesome.
It was like, everybody's like, this is ridiculous, it's stupid, it's like there's alligators and crocodiles and people getting eaten, and it's ridiculous, it's stupid, it's ridiculous,
and
I loved it. So
I
think it's going to be an interesting race to see whether it crawls to the top or closer to the top of the box office. We skipped that one. Or I don't even know if it was offered.
No, it was not offered. It went cold.
Yeah, and I think it, obviously that was
a might have been a mistake.
I don't know. I think it might have been a smart move if word of mouth, if people see it and it.
There's a critics lap this stuff up.
So yeah.
I think they would have raved. I have something for the audience.
Yeah.
I have been, so my wife, Kate, she doesn't do movies. She hasn't seen, she's seen like four movies. And I've been introducing her to cinema by way of the 80s. So we did Top Gun, and she said, oh, great, now I know all these references that people say. I feel the need for speed. She finally gets that. She didn't get it before.
Excellent.
Now she gets Top Gun. She didn't particularly care for it.
Oh, but, my goodness.
She liked, you know,
Kate.
What? No, I looked, when Goose died, spoilers, I looked over and she had straight up tears in her eyes.
Oh.
So that's the point there. She cried when Goose died.
Did she recognize Meg Ryan?
She did. She was shocked. She's like, really? And so last week, I showed her Stand By Me. Much more affected. She really, really liked it.
Sure.
And we got into it. We got into a film discussion, a marital film discussion. It was amazing. I knew it was going to work because, come on, it's Stand By Me. And when John Cusack showed up, just, I know.
Yeah.
Come on, it clinched. So I'm thinking tomorrow I'm going to show her The Goonies. She'd never seen The Goonies. And so we're talking Mama Fratelli, Chunk, Sloth.
I hate to tell you, but I don't think I've seen The Goonies all the way
Shame
through.
On you. But why I'm telling the audiences, our listeners, ping me. What should I show her next? Do I stay with the 80s? Do I move on? Because trust me, she hasn't seen anything. Do I go earlier than that? I don't want to bombard her with The Godfather. She doesn't want to watch The Godfather.
Now, I'm just going to throw these out there and people can either weigh in or not. But I would say, everything like Flashdance and Footloose.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh. You got to get those in there.
No.
Oh, man. Come on.
No.
Those are the ones
that. You can't go from Stand By Me to Footloose.
If I'm thinking about the ones that just.
Shame on you.
That I saw that I remember in high school that just had such an impact. Oh, my gosh. Footloose and Flashdance.
We did 16 Candles and we both. At the end, we're like, oh my God, you couldn't make this in 2019. Hashtag me too.
Well, she's done Breakfast Club, hasn't she?
I don't know. I don't know if she has or not. But
Breakfast Club's got to be on the list.
But yeah, I'll let you know the next time. I don't think we're podcasting next week.
No.
I think we're taking a break. You're going out of
town. I'm going to LA to actually, you know, check out the, I'm going to get a Stuber.
Are you going to go to Koreatown, Compton, Venice, Inglewood?
I only have one key location, and that is to see Wolverine, a.k.a. Hugh Jackman at the Hollywood Bowl. So as he wraps up his world tour.
I'd rather watch The Goonies and watch Hugh Jackman.
The Greatest Showman, baby. So yeah, but I'm going to see a movie, though, regardless, called The Farewell, that I was not going to see, except that everyone I know who's seen it is raving about
it. It's getting mad raves. I'm actually not going to go see that.
And it's playing right near us, so it's at Bethesda.
I might have to be your plus one because I miss the RSVP
You need to go see that one. That's Awkwafina.
No, actually, I was going to go on Tuesday to the press club to see Official Secrets.
Yeah, so I won't. I'll miss that.
And I'm thinking of Blinding by the Light about Bruce Springsteen. You know how yesterday just did the Beatles homage? Blinding by the Light's coming up, and it does a Bruce Springsteen
it's
homage.
It's too early for that one, though, because it doesn't come out till sometime in August. So I'm like, my brain will just get just oversaturated. So I'd rather let the Beatles music settle a little bit and then turn my attention to The Boss. But The Farewell is getting good buzz, so I'm looking forward, and we'll just catch up on that one. I'll talk about it a little bit in 2 weeks.
Quick recap. The Lion King recapped The Lion King. I stand by, if you still feel things about Mufasa and Simba, you'll feel things again. If you were like me and you're like, meh, you'll still be meh.
Yeah, and if you're like me, you'll just be singing Hakuna Matata again when it's been a while, Circle of Life, and Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Those are the three things that still resonate. It's the exact same story, but visually stunning.
Let's just never talk about Stuber again. It's stupid. It doesn't merit breath.
Maybe you should take a lift instead.
That means Denzel from The Equalizer would be driving that.
There you go. Because
they did Lyft.
Oh, okay.
Bethany Hamilton, colon.
Unstoppable
is, just stop.
It's stop.
I think it's branding.
It's hang 10 minus 10.
Did you just come up with that?
Yes.
And Marianne and Leonard, colon. Words of love.
If you want to learn something new about Leonard Cohen, and you thought you knew everything about Leonard Cohen, and all you know is the song Hallelujah, yeah, you'll learn something. And sometimes that's all a doc needs to be, but you don't need to go out and pay for it.
And a reminder, ping the Cinema Clash about what Kate needs to watch next.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.